Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to this week's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. Our host this week is Heisi Ludmers with Revolution. Heisi will take you on a journey into ancient Egyptian spirituality, offer some magic for today, and relate a message from the talking tree. Join Heisi and his guests for a journey down the Nile. Richard Reedy, author of Eternal Egypt, Ancient Rituals for the Modern World, speaks with us about the revival and continuing practice of Kemeticism, the spiritual and magical practice of ancient Egypt. Hear about Richard's own journey from Orthodox Christianity to a Kemetic path, how to incorporate the words and rituals of the ancient Egyptians today, how to get started if you're feeling drawn to an Egyptian-based spiritual path, and much more. Our Magical Moments segment continues our journey down the Nile as we are joined by a Kemetic practitioner offering us a magical technique for good health based on the ancient Egyptian practice of Heka, or magic. And the last part of the show offers you a chance to call in for live on-air readings. Hear what Egyptian god or goddess has a message for you and how you can put that message into action in your life right now. Firefly Willows LIVE Roundtable is an opportunity for all of our hosts to come together and share their thoughts, experience, and insights on a variety of topics. Listen in as each host takes a turn as moderator. This week, join Heisi Ludmers for today's roundtable topic, Independence or Interdependence? How do you see it? Coming right up.
Declaration of Interdependence by the David Suzuki Foundation, which can be found at www.davidsuzuki.org, and Suzuki is spelled S-U-Z, or as we say in the U.S., Z-U-K-I.org. And this is what they have on their website, and we would love to read it for you today for your consideration. It was written in 1992 for the UN Earth Summit in Rio. This we know, we are the earth through the plants and the animals that nourish us. We are the rains and the oceans that flow through our veins. We are the breath of the forests of the land and the plants of the sea. We are human animals related to all other life as descendants of the firstborn cell. We share with these kin a common history written in our genes. We share a common present filled with uncertainty, and we share a common future as yet untold. We humans are but one of 30 million species weaving the thin layer of life enveloping the world. The stability of communities of living things depends upon this diversity. Linked in that web, we are all interconnected, using, cleansing, sharing, and replenishing the fundamental elements of life. Our home, planet Earth, is finite. All life shares its resources and the energy from the sun, and therefore has limits to growth. For the first time, we have touched those limits. When we compromise the air, the water, the soil, and the variety of life, we steal from the endless future to serve the fleeting present.
This we believe. Humans have become so numerous and our tools so powerful that we have driven fellow creatures to extinction, dammed the great rivers, torn down ancient forests, poisoned the earth, rain, and wind, and ripped holes in the sky. Our science has brought pain as well as joy. Our comfort is paid for by the suffering of millions. We are learning from our mistakes. We are mourning our vanished kin, and we now build a new politics of hope. We respect and uphold the absolute need for clean air, water, and soil. We see that economic activities that benefit the few while shrinking the inheritance of many are wrong. And since environmental degradation erodes biological capital forever, full ecological and social cost must enter all equations of development. We are one brief generation in the long march of time. The future is not ours to erase. So where knowledge is limited, we will remember all those who will walk after us and err on the side of caution.
This we resolve. All this that we know and believe must now become the foundation of the way we live. At this turning point in our relationship with Earth,
we work for an evolution from dominance to partnership, from fragmentation to connection, from insecurity to interdependence.
Welcome everyone today to our roundtable. We're here once again in Studio C, and I'm joined by our Firefly Willows co-hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Hello.
John Caracella.
Hi there.
And Deb Caracella.
Good morning.
And we started off this roundtable with a declaration of interdependence that was put out by the David Suzuki Foundation. And that's because our topic today is independence versus interdependence. And what we think that the difference in definition of that is, and how we may exhibit that in the world today, one or the other, and whether we think that we need to be cultivating or striving for one or the other, or if they can coexist equally and successfully, versus perhaps needing to change our perception of what each of those means and not feel resistance to one or the other because we think that somehow one negates or takes away from the other. So the first thing that I might ask us to consider is, what would you say is your definition of independence? And then what would you say that your definition of interdependence might be?
So if I were to take a stab at independence, I would tend to equate that with one of two things. Either the very practical matter of my personal sustainability, my ability to operate in the world within the parameters of comfort that I like. You know, I can feed myself, I can drive the car I want, I have shelter and so on and so forth, as a kind of sense of independence. Or the other way is from the perspective of personal sovereignty, that I am complete enough in myself that I can engage the world with confidence that I'm here and present and accounted for and taking action in the way that I feel is appropriate for me. If I feel independent in that way of personal sovereignty, I don't feel like a victim. When I think of interdependence, the first thing that comes to mind for me is empathy. It's a way of seeing everything else in the world through the experience of those other things, knowing that those other things are inextricably part of my experience and therefore part of my reality and therefore part of who I am. So I'm interdependent upon all of the stimuli and all of the things that create that stimuli, because it is all that stimulation that creates my reality. And the more empathy I can feel, the more empathy I can experience with all of those things, the more wholly I can understand my own experience.
When I was listening to Hi-C talk about independence and interdependence, the energy that came into me was freedom. So for me, when I think about independence, I'm thinking about freedom. And then the next place that I landed was, depending on the degree to which you're free and independent, has an impact on the quality of your interdependence. So if there's a bunch of people who are masked and not free, they are not really able to bring a high quality interdependence to the table, as opposed to people who are free and unmasked.
I like that. That's good.
So that's where I went.
And I more or less, what Mildred just said is where I went, but I went from the point of view where Hi-C asked, can they reside together or do they exclude one another? Can you be independent and interdependent, or can you only be one or the other? I would hope that we can be both, that they aren't mutually exclusive, because I also went to the independent is freedom. It's the ability to make my own choices, be within my own space, not dependent upon anyone else to solve my problems, meet my needs, make me happy. And I like that. I enjoy that. I find that a very strong need in myself. But I also realize that meeting my own needs, making my own happiness, cannot be at the expense of someone else or something else. And so in that regard, I am never totally disconnected from all that is around me. My wants, my needs, my desires are not without impact on the beings, the world, the relationships around me. So all of that always has to be taken into consideration as I'm making my personal choices, as I'm living my personal life and exploring my personal freedoms. So yes, I want that. I want both. But I realize that so they aren't mutually exclusive. They have to work together. And I don't feel that I want to be on one end or the other. I don't want to be totally interdependent upon everything and everyone, but I don't want to be totally independent of all to the detriment of something either.
What would be your concern if you feel you are totally interdependent?
I have a real problem with when I feel that I am being obliged by someone else's need, by someone else's expectation, even if it's something that hasn't actually come from them, it's something that I've interpreted from them. I find that I react poorly to that. I bristle. I don't want to be trapped by a sense of being obligated to meet someone else's need unless I have given permission. That is where being completely interdependent upon everyone and everything makes me feel that there's a sense that something I have to give something up.
It creates a vulnerability to the loss of your free agency.
Yes.
While you were talking, Debbie, I was thinking about a story I read. There was a group of grade 6 children in the U.S., and they were asked to draw a picture of their environment, a picture of themselves and their environment. And then there was another class, and they were of Native American children, same age, and they were also tasked with the same opportunity to paint a picture of themselves in the environment. And let's say the mainstream children, the U.S. children, and this could apply to Canada or any country, I'm sure, drew a picture of their environment, the trees, the skies, the birds, the water, but their body was out of proportion with the scale of the different trees and waters and birds.
Mm-hmm.
Their body was much, much larger, much, much, much larger. And if we would go to the second class that were asked to draw themselves in the context of their environment, everything was in proportion. So the first one illustrates to me an example of independence out of proportion,
mm-hmm.
out of balance with the environment, whereas the second example is independence interconnected.
At the right scale.
At the right scale. So to me, it's kind of a scale question a little bit, too.
I think the word independence has gotten bastardized because it's come to mean freedom and liberty. But I think the way that people interpret that now is a sense of I can do what I want, when I want, how I want, and I shouldn't have to get anybody's permission, nor should I have to do it in any way other than the way that I want to, and I shouldn't have to worry about anyone or anything else in the process. I don't think that that's true independence, but I also think that there's no way for us to not be interdependent. You know, if we listen to, for example, the declaration that started off this segment, they certainly mention things about the sky and the plants and the earth and all of that. So we're all part of an ecosystem that can't somehow be separated from us as if all of this other ecosystem is for us to use without us having any sort of impact. And when Deb was talking about not wanting to be interdependent on others, if we actually look at our lives, I would say we're more interdependent now even than we might have been hundreds or thousands of years ago.
I agree.
I would ask, are you creating your own fuel for your car? Are you growing your own food? Are you pulling water up for yourself from a well that's on your land? And so if the answer to those kind of things is no, it means we're extremely interdependent on everyone else. Mm-hmm. And if independence is I can do what I want when I want, if all of the people that are growing and picking the food and shipping the food decide, you know, I don't feel like doing that today, that's going to have a huge impact. And then we see the interdependence. There was recently a huge storm in Washington, D.C. And all of a sudden, there's no electricity. All of the grocery stores are wiped out and clean, so there's no fresh anything for anyone to get. So whatever you have in your house, you kind of have to deal with till the electricity comes back. There's no gas at the gas stations. And we're suddenly starkly reminded of just how interdependent we actually are in our society. rather than being independent. And I think interdependence is something that is starting to make a comeback, if you will, because we hear more and more about community, whether it's with food, you know, buying local, or creating community co-ops or different kinds of arrangements within a community, like a community garden where everyone is sharing both in the work as well as in what comes from that garden, and having access to it rather than having to rely on someplace else for people that they never see to grow this, to bring it to them, but then of course they don't know how it's been grown, what is in it, etc. And so I think that if we really looked at it, we're much less a society of what we tend to think of as independence and much more a society of interdependence, but we don't seem to acknowledge nor honor that fact. And we live far more, at least in a mindset, independently, which then creates conflict and problem and challenge within the true interdependence that we're a part of in our society.
At the end of the day, we're no less dependent now than we were when we were struggling to craft shelter with stone tools or cultivate for the first time. We're still dependent on the planet. We're still dependent on what bounty the planet produces for us. That what's changed is that we have abstracted ourselves away from that process. So we have the illusion of independence. We have systems that funnel those resources to us, but we're not independent of those systems, as you pointed out, like in D.C. with the power outage. All of those systems, we are dependent upon those systems. What do those systems do? Those systems bring us the bounty of the planet. So without the bounty of the planet, we don't function. So we're no less dependent now than we were before. What we've done is we've made ourselves dependent upon and interdependent with a whole bunch of systems. So instead of being interdependent with a community, we're interdependent with a bunch of mechanical systems, architected systems that don't necessarily have a soul. What I see is a delusion of independence, an illusion of independence, because we have lost our empathic connection to the things that sustain us, mm-hmm. because they're machines, they're systems, they're impersonal, they're government, they're corporations, they're highways and cars, and how can we have any empathy with the resources that sustain us when we have no connection to it?
As much as we champion independence, I think that we have actually created systems where we have sacrificed and lost our independence, because when a system goes down, so let's say that a storm comes, a system goes down, now there's nothing at the grocery store, we suddenly panic wondering where are we going to get food from, rather than having that innate sense of, I can independently grow my own food. And we used to know how to do that, and in some ways without having to think about it because it was just what we did.
Right.
Now, we don't even necessarily have the knowledge of how to do that, let alone have an innate sense of, let me go to doing that. You know, the first thing that people think is, oh, I don't know when electricity is going to be back on, so I better start looking at planting or growing or cultivating some things that I'm growing myself. We just start panicking about when are they going to get the electricity back on so that there will be food on the shelves of the store
right.
for me to have.
So how would we, I guess as a collective, we become more aware?
Well, the whole locavore thing, like buying local, eating local, that's what I would say is a great place to start.
I would encourage people to start small, because start by having just your own small herb garden.
Because
suddenly you realize, I don't have to go to the store to suddenly get that fresh rosemary I need for this meal I'm making. And maybe I find that I'm actually saving money because I'm spending less at the grocery store on a regular basis, because I'm not buying all of these extra herbs that I normally would use, because all I have to do is walk over here and snip them from a pot or from my garden or something like that. And it doesn't have to be growing things. It might be sitting down. There was a great concept I saw about gift circles, where a neighborhood community comes together every week and they go around and say, this is what I received in the last week, this is what I need. And it may be something like, I need a ride to the airport on Tuesday, or I'm going to paint my bedroom on Thursday and could use some help with that, or I need a ladder. And then you go around and people who have those things to offer will then say, oh, I can come and help you on Thursday, or I could take you to the airport on Tuesday. But what you start to find is, in return, you're doing something else. So you have something to offer which may be different, but you're able to offer it, and then you're also getting something that you need back, which is that interdependence that we have. So there's already an inherent interdependence that I think we've both lost sight of, but we can start to connect back to through both simple acts, like starting, because interdependence with the plants, by starting to grow things for ourselves, and then expanding it out if you know, to start doing that either on a neighborhood level, a community level, and that kind of thing.
I think that with the interdependence, when you start engaging in this type of activity, it's going to bring a sense of fulfillment. And then you start engaging in interdependence activities, like Kai Seed was mentioning, I would imagine it's going to give you all kinds of different sensations and feelings, and 99.9% of them are going to be positive. And for me, that's where the power of interdependence is going to grow.
So I'd like to thank everyone for engaging in this conversation today. Hopefully it has inspired those listening to at least give some thought as to what independence and interdependence mean for them and how they might see themselves in an interdependent world rather than feeling so independent that what they want, what they do has no effect on others, nor does what happens outside of them have any effect on themselves. And to finish this segment, I'd like to finish it the same way that we started, by reading another Declaration of Interdependence, this one written by T. Thorne Coyle. So we will finish with that. So thank you very much to everyone for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A Declaration of Interdependence by T. Thorne Coyle. Information about T. Thorne Coyle can be found at www.thornecoyle.com, Thorne, C-O-Y-L-E.com. We, in order to create a more perfect union, declare our strength and beauty as individuals and our love and compassion for the whole. We acknowledge that the turtle and the sparrow, the carrot and the kale, the sandy ocean and distant stars are all our family. We pledge to love one another to the best of our abilities. We will cease to be at constant war and will learn to solve our disagreements amongst individuals and in small communities, not allowing them to spill over, affecting masses of beings. We will not pour toxins into the oceans, earth, and sky. We will cherish one another. We, in order to create a more perfect union, do claim our interdependence with every particle that exists. We pledge to dance on a regular basis and to sing.
Well, that's it for our roundtable this week. Many thanks to this week's moderator, Heisey Ludmers, and participants Mildred Lynn McDonald and Deb and John Caracella. We hope you found this roundtable discussion engaging and thought-provoking. If you would like to join the conversation, visit facebook.com/fireflywillows and add your comment under this week's roundtable post. Stay tuned!
When I was out for a hike recently, I came upon a tree, and you can see a picture of this tree in the slideshow of photos on the Blog Talk Show page or in the episode notes document at fireflywillows.com/live. It stood in the middle of an open field, and it seemed very magical to me, and I felt as if it was just calling to me and speaking to me directly. So I went over and sat with it and meditated in order to connect and listen to what the tree had to say to me. And I feel that the message that it gave me was something that it also wanted me to pass on. So I thought that I would offer the message that the talking tree gave to me to you. And this is what the tree said to me.
Carry this tree within you. Let it reside at your core. The breeze, the wind, is the breath of Shu. Upon this breath of wind is carried the ka, or the spirit, or the animating life force of Zeptepi, the first time, the moment of creation when all was in perfection. Encoded in the wind is the history of all that has been, the wisdom of all times. When you stand in the wind and breathe it in, you are inhaling the wisdom and experience of perfection and all knowledge, all experience, all time, all eternity. Whenever there is a need for guidance, for understanding, for ancestral connection, for the ability to think, decide, and act in Ma'at, in perfection, in perfect alignment with cosmic order, call upon Shu to bring the wind. Be in it. Feel it surround you. Breathe it in. Listen to the wind. Listen to the breath of Shu for the wisdom and guidance that you seek. The tree that you carry within uses the plant matter that hangs from it to stimulate the breath of Shu, the wind of wisdom. As the breath is invisible and amorphous, this hanging plant matter can temporarily catch it long enough to experience it and absorb it. But it will then move on, continue to blow and stir and circulate, wisdom and experience continually circulating into and out of the conscious realm to be accessed when needed, but perhaps to wait and have to blow through again when you are ready to receive, perceive, and take in some other wisdom.
My guest today is author and speaker Richard Reedy. Richard earned a Master of Divinity degree in 1979 and is the founder of two temples in Northern California dedicated to researching, restoring, and enacting the authentic rituals of ancient Egypt. He is a sought-after speaker on the Egyptian religious tradition and its legacy for modern times. Richard Reedy is the author of Eternal Egypt: Ancient Rituals for the Modern World, the first comprehensive collection of important temple rituals, seven key rites from official temple records and ancient esoteric texts for personal or group use. These ritual texts reveal the deeply spiritual understanding of humanity's relationship to divinity that characterized the ancient Egyptian sense of the sacred. Eternal Egypt is a practical intermediate level text for those wishing to authentically worship the great deities of ancient Egypt and to tap into the great spiritual heritage that sustained Egyptian culture for over 3,000 years. You can find Eternal Egypt at online retailers such as Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and you can contact Richard through his Facebook page at www.facebook.com/eternalegypt, or you can contact him directly by email at rjreedy, that's R-J-R-E-I-D-Y, at hotmail.com. So please help me in welcoming to the show today, author and speaker, Richard Reedy. So thank you, Richard, for joining us today and being willing to share your knowledge and your experience, especially in terms of ancient Egypt and the Kemetic spiritual tradition, with our listeners.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
The first thing I'd like to start with is maybe to just give people a little bit of a background regarding your spiritual evolution and where you came from and what brought you to the Kemetic path that you currently are now following.
That's a good question to begin with. I was raised as an Orthodox Christian in the Eastern Church. And I had a very happy experience there. I was so comfortable in that Christian denomination that I eventually went to theology school and studied full-time for 3 years in order to, this is after college, in order to earn my Master of Divinity. Instead of being ordained to the Orthodox priesthood, I worked for my denomination for quite a few years in New York, and as a consequence, I represented my denomination at the National Council of Churches, where I had an opportunity to meet with members of many different Christian faiths. By and large, these were mainstream Christian denominations, and I found that with the variety of Christian sects, that there was a great deal to admire, especially in terms of social outreach, as well as with real fervor in spreading the Christian gospel, but not in a coercive way. However, as time went on, after I had been in New York for over 10 years, and working in the church, I decided that Christian theology was less and less credible for myself. I had many problems with it, and as a result of that, I determined that I needed to stop my work in the National Council and in my denominational headquarters and seek another spiritual path. Spirituality and religion have always been extremely important for me. It was important in the lives of my mom and dad. And as now a non-Christian, I was searching for an alternative spirituality. And I wanted to explore religions of the earth. And ultimately, with a great deal of reading, I have a tendency to be rather academic in my approach to things. As a result of my reading and study and discussion, I was drawn more and more to religions of the earth, and ultimately to the ancient religion of Egypt. It seemed to me to be a well-nuanced theology and a beautiful conception of the relationship between the gods and humans. So, in a nutshell, I'm a hardline polytheist. And as that, my particular path is with the ancient gods of Egypt. I don't mean to say that other spiritual paths, either ancient or modern, are not good, useful, worthy of a blessing. Quite on the contrary, I find that pagans and neo-pagans of many stripes are all in agreement that one path is not better or solely the one leading to the divine. But all these paths offer a richness, a very rich tapestry of beliefs, expressions, rituals, and all of them are worthy of being followed by those who feel so called.
And what you follow or the way that you practice now is, in a general sense at least, considered more of a reconstructionist approach. Is that correct?
Yes. Reconstructionism is an attempt to research and revive the rituals of the ancient culture of Egypt. And fortunately, there are many, many ritual texts preserved on papyrus and on the walls of the remaining temples. And now that we can translate the hieroglyphs, and with over 190 years of Egyptologists working on deciphering that language, we have a rich storehouse of texts that give us great insight into the beliefs and practices of the ancient Egyptians. And I found in my own practice that those rituals, those prayers, those incantations are very powerful and very effective. I'm very practical, I'm a pragmatist, and I quickly lose interest in things that don't work. However, I have found that the rituals and the magic of ancient Egypt are extremely powerful, very effective, and good for building up a better world and helping individuals.
And for people that sometimes think that a reconstructionist approach to a spiritual path means we do it exactly the way they did it thousands of years ago. If you're not doing it that way, you're doing it wrong. And we don't try to embellish, change, add on to, or do it in any way different than they do or that they did. What would you say to that? Do you adhere that strictly to it, like you're only going to do it the way it was done thousands of years ago? Or that practical and pragmatic side, do you allow for that to be more of a guideline, but you allow for some alteration or creation of things?
Our religion, Kemetic Reconstructionism, is a living religion. And that means although we use the ancient patterns of worship, the ancient style of worship, the ancient words to guide us, we are not bound to limit ourselves to only those particular words or actions. It's a modern-day religion just as much as it was an ancient religion. Unlike the religions of the book, that is Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, those three religions are compelled not to change one single iota of the given texts of their belief system. However, as a comedic reconstructionist, I am able to take, or we are able to take those texts and put them in a modern context following the ancient pattern. And also, since so many temples to the gods were destroyed and we have very little left of them, we can nevertheless craft and create rituals based on a paradigm. As a matter of fact, the daily rituals of Egypt throughout all the temples were based on the paradigm in the great temple of Amun in Karnak. And so that prototype, which served the priests of other gods and goddesses throughout the land, that particular prototype can serve us today in creating beautiful rituals for those gods and goddesses for whom we do not have the artifacts and information as to the exact words that were used in their worship. But we do know that the Temple of Amun created the prototype that was used, and we see that in the temples that are remaining in ancient Egypt, that this, in fact, was the prototype. So we use that today, crafting rituals for other deities.
So it's interesting that you came from a more, one, I think, very well-informed theological background, as well as you tend to have a slightly more academic approach, the way you described that you like to do things. And I'm wondering if you've found over time, whether you've seen it in the past or maybe you've seen something new starting to emerge, do you find that there is any sort of acknowledgement of a modern-day tendency to revive or revisit ancient religions and spiritual traditions? Or do you find that it still just is really kind of set aside as superstition and there's really no acknowledgement or even any study of that in today's world?
Actually, I've been in contact with a doctoral candidate in Great Britain who now fortunately has been awarded his PhD and whose subject was precisely the reemergence of ancient Egyptian religion in the modern world. So he and I have had a number of very interesting discussions and email exchanges over these last few years, and I feel that academia is becoming more conscious of and respectful of modern practitioners of ancient religions. They find it, of course, interesting as an academic, but I think also there's an underlying respect for a spiritual path. Now, this is not, of course, universal. I'm not referring to all or even the majority of Egyptologists, but I think that there is a growing sense that the religions are being revived and that people are serious about it. You mentioned that I take a particularly academic approach, and that's true. That's for me. But as a matter of fact, most people coming to religion or practicing any religion, they don't have the time necessarily or the inclination to be highly academic about something. And that, I think, is a clue from the gods. That is a clue that it's good, proper, fine, and worthy of a blessing to approach deity in whatever way feels right and good for you. I think the deities are very, very interested in our mutual relationship. And I'll talk about that more in a bit, about the mutual relationship between gods and goddesses and ourselves as humans. Most persons who practice any religion will be drawn to one or another deity, god or a goddess, or one particular form of practice. And that's good. It's not a question of, well, you know, somebody else is going to tell you which deity is your deity or which deity to venerate or honor. Rather, the god is, in a sense, flirting with you. It's a love relationship. The God is attracting you. Perhaps it's because you like the picture of the God or goddess. You like the myths regarding the God or the goddess. These are all valid ways of a deity attracting us and our responding. And in my own situation, I was attracted to a particular Egyptian deity, and that deity provided me with a portal in which to enter and become more knowledgeable with the ancient religion. And I think that this is not unusual. Perhaps a person is drawn to the goddess Aset or Isis, or drawn to Jehudi, the god Thoth, or some non-Egyptian god, to Zeus or Hermes. These are all good things and a valid way to be called to a greater and greater participation with deity.
And part of your contribution to the continuation of the Kemetic tradition. And also, I think, something that is very useful for people who do start to feel called either by a particular Egyptian deity or to an Egyptian path is your book, Eternal Egypt, Ancient Rituals for the Modern World. And so I'm wondering if, first of all, you could just tell us what the genesis of that book was, where it kind of came from, and what prompted you to create that.
Well, over 15 years ago, a group of persons in San Francisco gathered together with me to explore ancient magic, ancient religious practices, and we all quickly were drawn to the gods and goddesses of ancient Egypt. And within a short time, and these are people from various spiritual traditions, Wicca, Vodou, and various other forms of spiritual tradition. And we all came at the right time, I think, to form a temple for the practice of the ancient religion, for study of the ancient religion. And we've been together now for a solid 14 years. Many of the same members participate in our monthly rituals. Others have moved away quite some distance, and so they're no longer able to participate in our monthly rituals due to distance. By and large, this temple has stayed together because of the appreciation that each person has in reviving and restoring this ancient religion. So it was very fortuitous that we all came together, and this has been the result. The reason I put together and crafted my book, Eternal Egypt, was so that if anything were to happen to the temple, as people move, as people change course in their lives, anyone leaves the temple for whatever reason, or death, that these things would not come to an end. But rather, we found that these rituals were so meaningful and so rich that I wanted to share them with as wide an audience as possible, so that others who don't have the time to read 50 books on Egyptology or to search through the academic journals, rather are provided with the means where they can study these texts and these rituals with commentary, because I just don't present rituals. There's plenty of commentary there so that people can be informed about what they're going to read in a ritual and how to conduct the ritual. So by getting it out there, and I'm surprised at how well received it's been, how people have written me, and for those who finally found my email address or got a hold of me, the wonderful questions they have, and so it keeps me on my toes to be able to answer them. And over the years, I've really built up kind of a nice, wonderful series of friendships with people all over the country and a few from abroad. So it's been very rewarding for me.
And from the temple that you initially formed in San Francisco, have also now come
sister temples that have grown in other locations as well. Is that correct?
Yes. Across the United States, there's a number of groups. You know, we're pretty small, but there's a number of groups who gather every month for ritual, and these groups seem to retain their membership. And I think one of the reasons why is our rituals are closed to the public, and so entry into the temple requires dedication. There's a testing period. There are assignments. There are a number of books to be read. And there needs to be a period of time where we get to see whether the initial enthusiasm or interest in our temple is going to be beneficial to the other members of the temple and also to that individual, whether they can commit to a monthly meeting for ritual, whether they can actively participate in and contribute to the temple. That way, we're able to make certain that for the individual, that this is a good fit. And we do have several instances where we've done public rituals, and that's at Pantheacon, which is held every presidential weekend in February in San Jose. And several thousand, well over 2,000 pagans and neo-pagans come together for a wonderful series of meetings and presentations and workshops and panel discussions and rituals. And for the past 2 years, we have invited people to witness one of our rituals in our hospitality suite. And so the room gets very crowded, but it seems to be extremely well received, and participation is very high. So for that, I'm very gratified.
And I think it's important, you know, regardless of whether it's a million people that are doing this across the country or whether it's a smaller number of people that are doing this, the fact that there are people doing it regularly means it continues to be a living and breathing religion or spiritual path. Not only does the people doing it continue to make it a living and breathing and ongoing spiritual practice and tradition, but also your book, which is not written as just a condensed academic approach or information for people, but it's actually rituals that are meant to be used and performed by people today. And so can you give us a bit of a sense of some of the types of rituals that are in your book that people would find in there that people could use if they were feeling drawn to or if they're already in the Kemetic path, and how those can be utilized and serve them in that?
That's a great question. The book Eternal Egypt has quite a few rituals in it. One, the morning ritual in the temple of Amun-Ra at Karnak, taken from the walls. The hieroglyphs on the walls guide a person through the ritual and provide a pictorial and a written guide as to what was done for daily ritual. We also have the nighttime ritual for the mystical union of Ra with Osir, that is, with Osiris. We have two rituals for the blessed dead. One ritual is performed annually. It's called the Beautiful Feast of the Western Valley. And that ritual, we're very fortunate to have the text for that particular ritual, and how wonderful it must have been when people during this time, which is generally around the month of May, went to the cemeteries and they had a festive meal with their blessed ancestors at the tombs of the ancestors. And another ritual is a ritual that can be performed more often. And that is for, again, for the blessed dead, for your family members, for your ancestors, for those that are part of your greater spiritual family who have passed away. Death does not conquer love. Love conquers death. That means that people who loved each other in life continue to love each other, even if one person is departed. That's a very important concept in ancient Egypt. This idea that that once a person dies, they're gone, you know, you have nothing to do with them anymore, just memories, that's not at all a Kemetic approach. That's not an Egyptian approach at all. Love conquers death. And so these rituals show that. It's a mutual relationship. We make offerings for our blessed dead, and they help us in this life. So it's not uncommon for a Kemetic to have an ancestral altar, as well as an altar to their particularly favorite goddess or god. In addition to that, we have three apotropaic or protection rituals aimed at negative forces. And this was done by priests in the temples on a daily basis to protect Pharaoh, to protect Egypt, to protect and promote Maat from harmful, wicked influences. Not everyone may be comfortable with that particular type of ritual or magic, but it definitely is worthy of considering and thinking about. And so I provide those rituals. In addition, we have rituals for the goddess Sekhmet, the great one of healing, and a ritual for Set or Setek, who was chosen by Ra as a defender of Ra. And we have a ritual for Jehudi or Thoth as Lord of Wisdom, Lord of Kindliness. I think that's one of my favorite epithets for Jehudi Thoth, Lord of Kindliness. And these rituals, those last three rituals to Sekhmet and to Setek and to Jehudi, are based on a prototype. And in addition to that, our temples, of course, have many, many other general rituals. And if anyone is interested in speaking with me about a ritual for a particular god or goddess, they can contact me at my email address, which is the initial R, the initial J, and then my name, Reedy. So rjreedy@hotmail.com. And I'm happy to try to accommodate you if you have an interest in a ritual for a particular god or goddess in the Egyptian pantheon.
And I think something that ties into that importance of the continuation of the tradition, that it continues to be a living and breathing tradition rather than an old or a dead tradition that was simply practiced by people in ancient times, is also something that you touched on when you were speaking of, say, the Feast for the Western Valley. I think a lot of people, and even Egyptologists, tend to think of ancient Egypt as basically people who are obsessed with death.
Oh, how mistaken they are.
And when you say that death does not conquer love, but instead love surpasses death, there's actually many, many indications that they were much more focused on life and the continuation of life even beyond death, rather than being obsessed with death.
Absolutely.
And, you know, one example of that, of course, and I think some of this comes through a modern-day filter that Egyptologists tend to fall into. And when I say modern-day, I'm including the past couple hundred years, not just today. You know, but even, say, the title that most people are probably familiar with, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is not really a proper translation of the title of that book, nor the intention of what is in that book.
I think you're absolutely right. The religion of ancient Egypt was a religion celebrating life, celebrating the living. And due to the accident of climate, a very dry climate, that preserved the tombs and the writings and drawings in the tombs, as well as copies of the so-called Book of the Dead, which really is the Book of Coming Forth into the Day. That's the actual Egyptian title for that book. The Egyptians were all about life and enjoyment and celebration. They also realized that at the end of this life, there was the next life, an afterlife, which they had the insight into understanding that the afterlife was an important apart and there was a relationship with this life. But they certainly enjoyed life. It was very much about enjoyment. It was not about self-denial. It was not a religion that was trying to escape physicality. It was not a religion that was trying to force asceticism on people. Fasting and penance and penitential practices were absolutely alien to the ancient Egyptian mentality. And as a consequence, it really is a religion of life and joy and celebration.
So the subtitle of your book is Ancient Rituals for the Modern World. And what would you say to someone who was wondering what value there is or what rituals from what ancient people did back 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago, what value those hold for someone today? And I know that most of what we have comes from temples and tombs versus coming from, we don't necessarily know a lot about what the everyday person's spiritual practice may have been. And what value is there, A, in the practicing of rituals from an ancient time, and what do they hold for us in today's world and for ourselves in our modern world? And B, I think that what your book really serves is it's offering the everyday person a way to bring that into their everyday life and spiritual practice versus it having to be something that, since there are no temples and no priests to go to, well, it can't even be done anymore.
I think that the ancient rituals provide a very rich resource for private practice, something that I feel is really important to get across is that it's not an either-or situation. Either one does the entire ritual or one does nothing from the ritual. I think as a modern person reading these ancient texts, the modern person may feel particularly moved or called by certain parts of the ritual, certain elements in the ritual. My feeling is adopt that part. Use that particular section that speaks to you. In my book, I try to add a lot of commentary, a lot of explanation, so that these images from thousands of years ago click with a modern mindset, make sense to a modern mind. The ancient rituals provide an extremely rich resource. And remember, anything that lasts for 4,500 to 5,000 years must have something going for it. And so these texts, which were performed in the temples for thousands of years, there's a certain body of energy. So energetically, doing these rituals, reciting these words, you are putting yourself back as an individual into an ancient time. And it's like a plug into an electrical socket. You're connecting with a tremendously wonderful power source. And that's just our experience, not just mine, but members of our temples, their experience, and why they come back month after month, year after year, because it provides a great boost, a great sense of rightness. And that's why I think these rituals have caught on and make sense to so many people.
Coming up after the break, we continue our conversation with Richard Reedy, author of Eternal Egypt, Ancient Rituals for the Modern World. We'll be discussing the inherent divinity within all of creation and how the ancient Egyptians saw that in the world around them, animal-headed deities, how to get started if you're feeling drawn to an Egyptian spiritual path, and more. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Richard Reedy in just a couple of minutes. Mm-hmm.
someone was coming even to your book for the first time or just starting to study various aspects of ancient Egyptian spirituality, there are things that may feel very foreign or confusing or are certainly very different in contrast to our modern way of thinking, even in terms of just the concept of, say, God. So could you just, in a kind of a general sense, characterize the thought philosophy, the spirituality of the ancient Egyptians, and some of the particular things you found to be perhaps different than how we tend to think of things today, and some of those things that we may need to be open to considering or adjusting if someone was deciding that they wanted to try to pursue a Kemetic path?
I think the ancient Egyptians, much like many modern-day pagans, saw this world and nature not as empty of content, vacant, hollow, but rather as filled with content, filled with a special spiritual, some would say, including myself, divine energy, so that this planet is holy. It is sacred. It is not fallen. It is not corrupt. We don't need to be saved from anything. But because it's holy, it can serve as a vehicle for divinity. Now that's where we get into the question of the sacredness of animals, the sacredness of the landscape, the sacredness of nature, and ultimately, the sacredness of each other. Our modern world is very impoverished in its materialist view that nature is empty of content, that it has no spiritual presence or meaning. The ancient Egyptians were quite in touch with nature, and they could see deity in nature, including animals. And so, you know, that can be something that modern people may have a hard time understanding. How can a cow or a crocodile or some other animal, an ibis, the bird, how can these animals show forth divinity? And yet the ancient Egyptians are showing us a way to do that, that if we look at animal behavior, if we look at the strength of the lion, if we look at the power of the crocodile, if we look at the soaring beauty of the hawk, that there is something divine and magnificent there. So many of us live in big cities. So many of us have fairly restricted contact with either animals or with nature. And so it's a little more difficult for some of us to connect on that level. But it's well worth the effort. And the Egyptians certainly saw deity in these animals. There's no two ways about it. That, I think, is something that's a unique gift from ancient Egyptians.
So I think one of the more challenging things for at least a modern Westerner to understand or to move beyond is that, you know, the ancient Egyptians and their approach to both their spiritual practice as well as simply their cosmology and their understanding of the world around them preceded any sort of monotheistic way of conceiving the universe. And even if someone is not brought up in or is not necessarily a follower of a particular monotheistic spiritual tradition today, there's still kind of this osmosis that we get from our overculture, this idea of God versus the more polytheistic way of being able to see things. So could you maybe expand a bit on what you have found to be the thought or the conception of deity and the gods from the ancient Egyptian way of seeing it?
The ancient Egyptians saw individual gods, so they were certainly polytheists. They were not crypto-monotheists. They did see all creation, including the gods, coming from one and multiplying into the millions of millions. And there is the perception that this is good, that this is right and proper. The great richness of that one multiplying out, not being simply aspects or faces or masks of the one, but actually having a unique individual existence. This was a really important idea. Now, today, some in the pagan community look upon all goddesses as masks or aspects of a single goddess, or masks or aspects of one god. Ancient Egypt did not do that. They were genuine, deep polytheists. And I think that there is a richness in polytheism, just as in humanity. We come, perhaps, from just a few humans millions of years ago, but we have multiplied, and we are millions of millions. We are billions of billions. We're not all just one. We're not masks of that one. We're not aspects of that one. We are unique and individual. And it's my belief, my feeling, that the gods and goddesses are precisely the same. They are unique individuals and deserve to be approached that way.
I think one of the most unique and probably one of the most recognizable or well-known aspects that many people, even if they're not familiar with ancient Egyptian spirituality or whatever, is the association of animals with deity. Whether it's the animal-headed human form that many people would at least know they've seen. Could you maybe speak a bit to what that symbolism or the importance of that connection was between both the gods and animals, as well as even the way that the Egyptians would see the animal itself, such as the baboon itself, would be seen as the incarnation or the manifestation of Jehudi, of Thoth. Could you maybe speak a bit to that to help people understand a little bit more of what that might have meant to the ancient Egyptians and why it wasn't just a fanciful way of illustrating or symbolizing their gods?
It certainly wasn't a fanciful way. It was well thought out, and it was based, I think, it was coming from the richness of Egyptian theology. It was a recognition that deity is in human beings. Deity is in animals. And the combination of the two, whether we're showing Anubis, that is Anpu, with the head of the jackal, or whether we're showing the great goddess Sekhmet with the head of the lion, these were very down-to-earth, material ways of representing the great powers of these deities. And so the animal itself manifested aspects of that deity. And so the Egyptians had the genius of combining the two. You find this in modern-day Hinduism also, with animal forms of deity, with certain human aspects, whether it's hands or feet or whatever. But there's a certain intuition that the Hindus have, and today we Reconstructionists also. So it may be something that at first an individual may not be totally familiar with or even comfortable with, but my attitude toward this is give it time. Give it a chance. Try to understand it on a deeper level. That would be my advice.
Something you had mentioned a couple of minutes ago was the concept of the one becoming millions of millions. And whether this is a modern interpretation of this or this is the way that people back then might have thought, we see a lot of times people who will say, oh, well, if my tradition has this particular god or goddess that exhibits this particular characteristics or qualities, then that is the same as this Egyptian god. So like the Greeks, a lot of times you'll hear people say, well, for them, you know, Hermes was Jehudi, just by a different name for the Greeks. And I don't necessarily hold to that view. But I'm wondering if you have something that you might want to say to that. If you think that the same gods are seen by all people, they just see them with different names, or does the idea of the millions of millions lead you to think that actually those gods are distinctly different and separate, even though there may be very similar qualities or characteristics that you could say, well, yes, that's very similar too, but it's not the same as?
There can be a tendency to syncretism, to identify one goddess with the goddess of another spiritual tradition or one god. You know, the idea that, oh, the Greeks had Zeus and the Egyptians had Amun, and so this is the same deity. I think that that leads to a rather impoverished view of deity. I truly believe in millions of millions. Just look out on a starry night if you're out in the country where there's no light obstacles preventing it, and look at the Milky Way, and look at the millions and millions of stars out there, planets and galaxies, solar systems. And if we know this is there in nature, why is it so hard to understand that the gods are millions of millions?
So if someone expressed to you that they were in some way feeling called to the Kemetic path or to follow a Kemetic spiritual practice, what advice would you perhaps give them, or what guidance would you perhaps give them as a way to start down that path?
Well, first of all, I would like to know how they came to be interested in ancient Egypt or in a Kemetic path, and if it was because they felt interested in and attracted to a particular goddess or god, then I would say that that is the way to pursue their interest, to find out more about that goddess or that god, and that that will naturally lead to an interest in exploring other aspects. As I said much earlier, not everyone needs to go into a very academic approach to ancient theologies, but rather to follow their heart and to start building a relationship with that goddess or that god, so that that deity is going to help you and guide you. And so you listen to the interior. This is not a religion of the book. In the religions of the book, the Christian goes to the priest or minister to understand the words of the Bible. The Jewish person goes to the rabbi. The Muslim person goes to the imam. And it's the imam or the priest or minister or rabbi who tells you what the book means. No. The gods speak directly to us. They speak quietly to our heart. And so we're okay, and it's right to follow that intuition. People can guide you. I can guide. I can help in an advisory capacity. So can other Kemetics. But always, ultimately, it's your own judgment and how you feel about it. And the gods will work with you.
And I think sometimes people can get excited when they are discovering or being drawn to something new, and they may jump into the deep end rather than wading into the pool. And so if somebody picked up your book and thought, oh, I'm going to start doing a Kemetic path now, and here's some rituals, so I'm going to start doing those, they may feel overwhelmed because those rituals may seem long or involved or complex, or there may be some aspects within them, whether it's the language or things that are referred to, that may be very foreign or confusing because there's just no previous knowledge of them. And part of the advice, even if they wanted to pick up your book to start with, may be to focus on that deity that has perhaps called them, if that's how they're being called to the path. But instead of saying, well, now let me do this whole ritual, they might just look through it and say, let me find a hymn or a prayer or something that is for that particular deity that I can start to say that ultimately will actually reveal more of that deity to them, because so inherent in those, in the ancient Egyptian way of writing things with the epithets and referring so much to the qualities of a particular deity and that kind of thing, or roles, just reading that can give you so much insight and help to expand your understanding of that deity. And so I think that it's important also for people that are feeling drawn to that or just starting, that it's okay to start with baby steps. And a baby step doesn't mean do a whole ritual that may take you 2 hours and now you're feeling overwhelmed or confused and so you start to feel very dissuaded from trying to continue doing it, versus go in and find some portion of it that you can utilize to start expanding your understanding and connection. And then from there, you may build a practice that starts to do more complex or involved ritual or not, but simply to not let yourself overwhelm yourself from the very beginning, because looking at something may feel very big or confusing. And that's where I think sometimes allowing yourself to do some education work is important, because you start to say, I don't understand what this is, and rather than tossing it aside because you don't understand it, say, I'm going to try to find out what this might mean or what this might be by looking up, say, the academic description or explanation of what that might have been or where that might have come from.
Well, that's why in my book I try to give a lot of explanation and commentary, and I also have hundreds and hundreds of endnotes so that people can see precisely where I got a ritual item or a particular utterance or recitation or ritual action, so that they can go to the academic sources. I'm not making something up. I'm not putting out there my own little spiritual take on something. I'm genuinely trying to provide guidance and access to those academic sources and put it in a popular form. And people can always contact me with questions. I also like to recommend a book called Temple of the Cosmos by Jeremy Nadler, N-A-Y-D-L-E-R. Jeremy Nadler is a Brit who has written a very comprehensive book on ancient Egyptian spirituality. That's what Temple of the Cosmos is. So that there you have the broad sweep of Egyptian theology. And it will provide very useful, very interesting information about the ancient Egyptian view of creation and of the gods and of mythology. So that's a good place, in addition to my book, Eternal Egypt, to start reading Jeremy Nadler. Other books I certainly could recommend, but I'd like to do that on an individual basis, depending upon person's interests and person's time availability. And so they certainly, I hope, will contact me at my email. Again, I'll give it. It's rjreedy@hotmail.com. So I hope people will feel free to contact me. And I also realize people may have multiple spiritual practices. They may be members of another spiritual tradition, and they like certain things about Egyptian spirituality. That's all good. It isn't like some other monotheist religions where you've got to take their religion and that's it, and don't mess with any other religion. You know, not at all. People are called to different aspects of different paths.
And I also think you would encourage people, if they did pick up your book as a starting point, to be willing to and are free to adapt the rituals in some way, to perhaps take portions to condense it down to a more manageable ritual for them to do.
There is, in fact, in my book, there is a very small 5-minute ritual. That particular ritual can, I realize people are very busy with jobs, with children, with other activities, and so may have very limited time to do any ritual at all. But I think it's important to do something every day. It can be very brief, just a couple of minutes. It doesn't have to involve a lot. You can, if you have a statue of a deity, or if you have a picture of the deity, that can be the focus point for your own personal altar. You might go there and offer a little tea candle. You might offer bread or water or some fruit or some other food. You can either use the very brief ritual in my book or just speak to the deity in your own words.
And just as important as speaking to the deity is also being willing to be still and to listen, because the deity will speak back, but we have to be quiet enough to actually allow that and to hear it.
Yes, once a person starts down this path, they may be very surprised at how the deity responds and speaks to them in the quiet of their mind, and good things will happen. That, I promise, good things will happen.
So thank you very much, Richard, for having joined us today. I've no doubt that people listening have found what you've had to share with them both interesting and intriguing, as well as probably piqued the curiosity of a lot of people to want to pursue it further. And I would certainly encourage them, if that is the case, to pick up your book, to contact you directly if they have some particular questions. And hopefully we can have you back in the future to continue expanding on this and perhaps find out some more information on some specific areas or topics.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. And I hope, as you said, I invite people to contact me. I'm happy to try to answer any questions that you might have.
You can contact Richard Reedy by emailing him at rjreedy, that's R-J-R-E-I-D, as in David, Y, at hotmail.com. You can also contact him or find out more about him at facebook.com/eternalegypt. And you can find his book, Eternal Egypt, Ancient Rituals for the Modern World, at online retailers such as Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Richard Reedy, and stay tuned. Coming up next in our Magical Moments segment, we'll be doing an Egyptian-based spell for good health that anyone can do. And following that, we'll have our final segment with live call-in on-air readings, where you can find out what Egyptian god or goddess may have a message for you to give you guidance, to respond to a question you may have. And I'll be joined by Fred Isom, intuitive coach and trainer from The Inner Voice, for that segment. So I encourage you to Skype in or call in. The phone number is 646-716-5510. We'll be right back with our Magical Moments segment right after this. Joining us today for our Magical Moments segment is Webin Banu, and Banu is a Kemetic practitioner, and she has been generous to offer to lead us through an ancient Egyptian-based spell that is for bringing and maintaining good health for us. So thank you very much for having joined us today, Banu, and welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Icy. Thank you for having me here.
I'm really looking forward to this because I think it'll be really good for people who are listening to realize that looking to how the ancients approached and performed magic is still something that is very relevant and even practical and doable for us today. So thank you very much for being willing to share this particular spell and, in more general sense, this particular approach and process for being able to bring that ancient way into a modern day practice.
Absolutely. Ancient Egyptian magic and ancient Egyptian religion is a living tradition. It's not all about copying what you can find in one tome or another. It's very relevant to modern life, and living it today is very important. But also understanding the techniques that go behind the traditions, why they're important, can really help us to apply those techniques in an appropriate way for the modern time. Sometimes, as I read literature from ancient Egypt, just hearing their voices, and it sounds like they're facing the exact same things that we're going through today. And it's just so funny to me how easy it could be to see these ancient sages and these words that were written thousands of years ago coming out of the mouth of my next-door neighbor, or myself even.
As if we're experiencing the human condition, they were simply experiencing the ancient condition.
That's a good point. That's a good way of saying it.
Could you just give us a little bit of context and background for what prompted you to create this spell, as well as what it's about, how you approached creating it?
I decided to create a spell for health and good healing, since that is something that's very important to me in my life. And I used Historiola,
divine stories about divine actions, which are so strong and so recurrent. And if you can take your own situation and nudge yourself into those paths, then it'll guide the progression of the spell in such a way that if you know the end of the story, you know where that energy is going to be going. And that's a very traditional technique in ancient Egyptian magic. You'll see it used many, many times. And it's a very practical means for modern people who are going to be creating a spell to find a story which resonates with their situation and then use that to guide the energies which they would like to convey through their spell work to guide it towards the appropriate end.
And this particular spell, actually, you're calling to Hathor?
I chose Hathor because I knew of a story in which Hathor gave healing to Heru, and I knew that I could harness that pathway as a means of delivering this good health spell.
Would you recommend this spell for someone who is dealing with a health issue and is in need of healing, or could it also be used to simply preserve and maintain good health if someone is already in good health, or both?
It's meant for both.
So I think the first thing we'll do is, why don't you just give us a list of the things that are needed in order to perform this particular spell?
In order to perform this particular spell, you're going to need a pitcher of whole milk, two identical small clear bowls, or wine goblets with deep and spherically shaped bowls. The idea is to kind of create the globe of an eye. You'll also need a small strip of new papyrus. A parchment paper would be fine, or even regular paper. Some clean, clear piece of paper which hasn't been used for anything else, which you can dedicate to this spell. In green food coloring, some sort of writing instrument to use with the food coloring, and your Eye of Heru amulet.
And the writing instrument, what I have found is very easy to find, very inexpensive, and very practical to use, are bamboo skewers. So once these items have been collected and now somebody is ready to do the spell, can you walk us through how to arrange or set things up before actually starting to recite the words of the spell?
You want to find some sacred space, altar would be good, or some place where you are comfortable communing with the sacred. Set up some incense, candles. You would want to have your two bowls or goblets set out, your milk close at hand, and your paper and your writing instrument ready to be used, and your Eye of Heru amulet. Write your request for your healing in green food coloring on your piece of paper or papyrus. You want to try to write it concisely and say it in a positive way. For example, you would want to write an example of something that you wanted in your life rather than something that you didn't want in your life or something which was causing harm for you. The idea is to write down what would make you whole, what would make you healthy and happy. Good health would be good, or a healthy respiratory system would be fine if you're having problems with cold, but not arthritis, because you don't want to invoke that. A better choice would be flexible joints or supple joints. And once you have inscribed that papyrus, just put it in front of a shrine, and while the ink is still wet, place the eye amulet on top of it. To either side of that, place a goblet or a bowl, and have a pitcher of milk nearby.
So the first thing to keep in mind is that what you're writing on the papyrus or the piece of paper is what you want to manifest or attract into you, not what it is that you are wanting to get rid of. You have generously offered to read through the spell so that anyone listening, A, can hear how it is said, what it sounds like. But I also believe that if someone starts to focus their intention on a particular health issue that they want to bring into their life in some way, they will also gain benefit even just from the energetic aspect of you reciting this spell now for them, as long as they see it being said for themselves. Perhaps not the same as if they do it for themselves, but there still is a benefit.
Absolutely. The story that I used for this ritual, it involves a story where the god Horus, or Heru, went up on top of a mountain after a very unpleasant altercation. And Heru's wife, Hathor, she found him injured, and she took the milk of a gazelle, and she filled the orbs of his eye with this milk, and in so doing, she was able to magically restore his sight to heal him. And so this is the image which we're working with in this spell, where you present yourself as Horus or Heru. You're injured. You're needing something in order to make yourself whole. And the two bowls or goblets represent the eye sockets. The milk that you're using will represent the milk of the gazelle, which Hathor used to heal Horus. The papyrus on which you have written your request, and the amulet, which you will be using for the spell, will be placed in either one of these glasses in the context of this spell, and the milk poured over on top of it, both to fill this orb of the eye and to give its powers of healing, which we can see are demonstrated as a magical precedent through Hathor's use of the milk. So that's the background to this spell, and I have it prefaced with another spell, a spell for becoming who, which can be used either in front of this spell or in front of pretty much any spell in order to identify yourself with the god who is authoritative utterance, just to give your heka, your magic, a little bit of extra authority and power.
And in the recitation of the spell, there's a portion where you say, I come to N, born of N. Can you explain what that indicates when you see that in a spell?
Yes, that's a very traditional means of identifying the target of the spell. The first N is the name of the person for whom the spell is being worked. And then the second N, the born of N, is usually the mother's name.
So we begin with the spell for becoming who, in order to imbue our words of magic with divinity. Stand before the shrine or altar or image that you are using with your arms in what is called the dua gesture of adoration, which is arms upraised, palms facing out or forward towards the shrine or altar.
I am the Eternal Spirit. I am the sun that rose from the primeval waters. My soul is a god. I am the creator of the word. Evil is my abomination. I see it not. I am the creator of the order wherein I live. I am the word, which will never be annihilated, and this my name of soul. Now I am who? What I said was good. And what came forth from my mouth was good. And what I now say, the same shall be performed. For I am man.
And now the words to be said to Hathor.
I praise the Golden One. I worship Her Majesty. You who are the mistress of life, who creates all nourishment, the beautiful one, whose favors are great, and the radiant one who gives sight to the blind. Men and gods bow down out of their great love for you. They say to themselves, "Behold, she comes. She who knows how to make proper use of the heart, who inundates the lands and the rivers with favors. She who makes the two lands green by means of her scepter of life. Hathor comes. O kindly one, may you turn your radiant face towards me. Majestic one, who listens to prayer, hear me. Powerful one, who protects the one who invokes her, protect me. For I am as Heru, who had taken himself up on the mountain. All searched for him, but none could find him. He lay in pain, blinded and in great need from the afflictions of his body, until you found him. My eye has been plucked from me, buried in the ground. It springs forth in new life and beauty, but I cannot see it, and my hands cannot reach it."
Hold your hand out over the amulet and papyrus, palm down, as you recite.
"Your eyes, Hathor, my life and my love. Your eyes see it. You see what is written, and you know what is needed."
Take the eye amulet and place it in the left goblet, and the papyrus in the right goblet.
"I am she whose favors are great, who makes the Ennead and causes the gods to live. I am she whose love is great, protectress to the one who invokes her. I come to heal this affliction, to assure a happy old age, and to leave good health and vigor in its place. I come to N, born of N, just as I came to the aid of my beloved."
Pour milk into each goblet.
"With my hand, I take this pure milk, and I fill the orb of your eyes with it, clean, fresh, and whole. I restore your eyes to you. Receive them."
Pause for a moment and reflect on the treasure you have been given. Feel the love and the healing power of the goddess, and let it enter into your body with the scent of her in the air you breathe. Take up the goblets, one in each hand, and hold them up before the shrine.
"I receive my eyes from your hand, O my goddess. I give thanks to the beautiful one, in all her name."
Drink the milk from both goblets.
"After it is done, place the eye amulet on a string and wear it. Take the papyrus strip and bury it someplace which gives life and nourishment to you or to members of your community. Gardens are wonderful for this, or a well-loved park is also a good choice. If you ask for something specific, then once this is granted, either offer the eye with a prayer of thanks into fresh water, a river or water reservoir is ideal, or bury it as you did with the papyrus. If you ask for general good health, then consider reworking this spell once a year, and each year give the old eye as an offering of thanks, so that the gifts of the goddess may be renewed in both yourself and the land around you."
Well, thank you very much, Banu, for having joined us for this episode, as well as for sharing this particular spell that you have crafted.
Thank you. I sincerely hope that this is helpful to someone.
The spell you just heard, as well as any additional information about the guests or the topics on today's show, can be found in the episode notes document at fireflywillows.com/live. And in that document, you will find an actual copy of that spell if you wanted to do it for yourself, with the text and the directions and information about it. And now we go to our regular segment, Beneath the Veil,
which gives you an opportunity to call into the show or Skype in from the show page and receive a live reading on air. You can Skype in by clicking the button on the show page, or you can call 646-716-5510. For the segment today, I am joined by Fred Isom, who is an intuitive coach and trainer and owner of The Inner Voice. So welcome, Fred, to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Glad you're here, and thanks for taking a little time out from, I believe, a little vacation you were on in order to do this with us.
Actually, just on the way back, so feeling nicely refreshed and ready to do this.
Excellent. Before we start, can you just tell people how to contact you if they were interested in getting a reading or doing some coaching or training with you, email address, phone number, website?
Sure. I'll go ahead and give out my cell phone number, which is 314-255-5877. I'll admit to being on vacation, on so much vacation mode that my details page has left my possession some way, somehow, so I don't have all that right in front of me at the moment.
Okay. So then can you just repeat that phone number once again? And if you can, maybe a little slower, so if people need to write it down, they can.
Sure. 314-255-5877. And also, once I actually get back to home, as I'm actually in transit from where vacation was, getting back to home, have another few hours ahead of me, I'll send you contact information that you can post on the page.
Yeah, I'll put that into the episode notes document that people can look at on fireflywillows.com/live anytime after the show.
Sure.
And what approach or tools or process are you going to be using today for our readings?
Well, I was pondering that on the drive here, and what's speaking to me the most today, what I'm feeling the most inclined to use, is good old-fashioned common sense intuition. Also, my clairvoyance has been sort of active lately, so for folks who don't necessarily understand what clairvoyance is, that's the ability to psychically see images clearly, and then also possibly a bit of clairvoyance. This is just the ability to, you know, clearly feel something, just that intuitive nudge, that intuitive knowing about something.
My guess is that your relaxed state from vacation, as well as a little full moon that was out earlier in the week, probably is what's kicking that into high gear for you.
Oh, absolutely. And I just had about 3 days in a isolated cabin off of a lake on three sides with a gorgeous moonlit reflection coming off of it. So fully charged and lovely views to bring me into the space.
Excellent. And what I'll be using is, keeping with the Egyptian theme of the episode, the Anubis Oracle by Nikki Scully, which if anyone listening wanted to check that out, you can go to anubisoracle.com, anubisoracle.com. And I will use that to connect with whatever Egyptian god or goddess might have a message for us. And then if you, Fred, can then take that and see what it is that you get on how to bring that message or that guidance into the everyday world as an action item or something that someone can do on a very tangible, real world, right now kind of way.
I will do my best.
All right. So if anybody has a question and would like to call in, feel free to do that. And as we wait for somebody to do that, I think what we'll start with is we will do a general reading basically for anybody that's listening right now or anyone that happens to be listening at any time, whether it's an archive show or a podcast that's downloaded from iTunes of the show, because a message will come through when we need to hear it. So regardless of whether we're putting the message out today or you're hearing it a week from now or 3 months from now when you're listening to an archived version of this show, that's when you need to hear that message, and it will still be just as valid and relevant for you as it is at this moment. So, sound good to you, Fred?
Sounds good.
All right. So the first thing that I'll do is I'm going to go ahead and see which god or goddess wants to come in and say, here's who wants to speak, and here's what we need to be hearing from them right now. And actually, two cards popped up. So
twice the information.
That's right. So interestingly, because of the way this deck is, it has some things that are in addition to just what we would think of as the deities of ancient Egypt. And one of those popped in, and what that is the Sphinx. And the Sphinx is, here in this deck, they call it the Earth Altar, because one, we don't really know how old the Sphinx is, and two, there are many people that believe that the Sphinx is a sort of repository of ancient wisdom and knowledge. And when it comes up like this, what it's saying is, I think, first of all, the Earth Altar aspect says it's very important to start creating a time and a space for us to set aside for ourselves to sit and to listen and be with the divine or whatever it is that we connect to. In the interview, we heard the importance of taking time to be still and listen to what a particular god or goddess that might be calling to us has to say to us. And one, we might be surprised who that is. Two, we might be surprised what it is that they have to say to us, but we're not going to hear it if we're not quiet and setting aside a time and a space for it. But the Sphinx is also calling us, you know, sometimes it's related to the Akashic records or the collective unconscious. And so it says there's this ability for us to tap into a greater repository or a greater database of knowledge and experience and wisdom from all time. We just have to be willing to do it. And, you know, the Sphinx is about being very set. So it's finding a structure for us to do that, to find a way to put that into practice that has form and structure and discipline so that we are doing it in such a way that it's regular, which allows it to build on itself rather than haphazardly, or we just ask a question, want an answer, and then we don't connect again until we need something else, and then we go and we ask again, which isn't really a mutual relationship, but a very one-sided relationship, which says, I need or want something, now what can you do for me? and the other card that came up with that is from this deck called Sacred Purpose, which is it's kind of a combination card, and so it includes the gods Ptah, Nut, Geb, and Anubis. So the first thing that we see, it's a number seven card. Seven is about commitment, so it's time to start committing to seeking out and following our path or our sacred purpose in life, to what we feel called to be doing, to start putting that sacred purpose first and foremost for ourselves, so that we look at everything in our lives and whether it is corresponding to and supporting and moving us along that path or towards that purpose rather than distracting us from it. Ptah is a creator god, and he brought existence into creation through speaking it. So it's the importance of putting what you have or what you want to bring into your life into being by speaking it, by writing it down, but by somehow bringing it out of you and giving it form and expression. Nut and Geb. Nut is the sky goddess. Geb is the earth. And they represent divine union, the idea of everything coming together into union and wholeness. So, and there's a eternal longing between the two of them. And so that's that sacred purpose. Whatever you have that deep-seated longing for that you know you've been called to do, have been wanting to do, or feel your path or purpose is, it's time to bring that into wholeness in your life so that your life is focused on and towards doing that and moving towards that. And Anubis often will come in as a guide in the dark. So he reminds us that there will be guidance for us when we aren't quite sure what step to take or what direction to go, but we have to put our hand out and ask for the guidance rather than thinking that it's going to be offered to us just because we said we want it and now we just sit and wait for it to come. So we have to put the effort into looking for and asking for the guidance or reaching out to who or what we need to move down that path or on that sacred purpose, rather than waiting for it to come to us. which goes back to the Sphinx, saying that there is divine guidance and wisdom, but you have to be willing to connect with it, to do your part, to create space and silence in order to hear it, and then to be willing to take action once you receive that guidance, but know that you will have assistance in that if you ask for it and when you are willing to do that. So there's my portion. I will now hand it over to you as to what you're getting that people can start doing right away in terms of maybe connecting with that guidance or moving towards that sacred path or letting go of the distractions that they allow to get in the way.
Sure, absolutely. And I find the message that has come through just from this already resonates to exactly why I chose to be where I am right now for this reading session. As I was on vacation, you know, I'm standing in the living room of the cabin, looking out the bay window, seeing lake around me on three sides, you know, seeing tall evergreen trees around the cabin, thinking this, you know, this is perfect. But then it suddenly struck me, do I want to be more land-based? Do I want to be near water? Do I want to be in the country? Do I want to be in the city? And the very root of that, it came to me, is that whenever it comes to finding ways of plugging into sacred space, finding a way to get into a routine about something that will bring you into a higher state of being, a higher state of consciousness, so that you can carry out the things that you need to carry out that will advance you both in your everyday life as well as in your higher life, in your higher purpose, you need to think about where are the places where I can plug myself in and truly feel sacred. Where are the places where I can go and feel authentically me? And so, just giving an example, I'm standing on top of a building, which has actually been converted into a park, overlooking a beautiful, and I happen to be in the city. I'm not out in the country at the moment. I'm in an urban environment. I'm surrounded by lots of people, lots of different energies. But by the same token, this is a very pastoral, tranquil setting because I'm in a park. I'm already feeling at ease because I'm around nature. I'm looking out over a beautiful lake. So in a practical way, it's about finding the things in your everyday life, the places in your everyday life that you know bring you peace, bring you a sense of openness, allow you to focus and clear your mind while you have that time that you set aside on a daily, a weekly, every other week, whatever the frequency is that you set aside that time to do, find those places in which you can just be you and focus on yourself for a few moments. And whether you're doing an actual meditative activity that's involving certain tools and instruments, or whether you're just sitting and being in the moment to ask questions of yourself, ask questions of deity, and allow those messages to come back to you. And also bearing in mind that whenever you get into those spaces where you're truly open and feeling aware and trying to, you know, ask the questions of why, how, when, it's not necessarily going to be, you know, a whisper in your ear. You may just the sudden rush of, I know what I need to do. Knowing what you need to do can flush over you. But you have to be. You have to find ways to get into those spaces to where you can truly be your most authentic self, to where you can relax and you can unwind a little bit and you can clear your head.
All right. Perfect. And we do have a caller, so this is going to challenge us because we're going to have to see just how concise and brief we can be.
All right.
Because we're going to have to do this in about 4 minutes.
Understood.
So, caller calling from 415, from area code 415, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, well, hello. What's your name and where are you calling from?
My name's Catherine. I'm calling from San Francisco.
Well, welcome to the show. Do you have a particular question for us?
I'm looking more for general guidance, particularly in the venue of emotional health, anything that the gods might have to say to me to help me in my daily life.
Okay. So the first thing that comes in from the Anubis Oracle is a card called the Nile, which is representative of the sacred element of water. So I would encourage you to relax and go with the flow. Water can be associated with the emotions, so there may be a sense that things are going to start flowing better for you. But I think what will help that is, one, literally drink more water, two, be around water more, and maybe take baths, be by the ocean, be by a river, whatever it is. But really bring water into your life in a more direct and immediate way. And the deities that came through, it's a card that has both Sobek and Horus. Sobek is the crocodile god, Horus is the falcon god, which represents a reconciliation of opposites, the old and the new. So it's letting go of some of the old, but also finding a way for the old to start to be expressed in a new way in your life rather than continuing to do it in the old way. And this is also a card that can represent things like forgiveness and understanding. So part of emotional health may come from being willing to let go of some things that we're carrying around emotionally, to forgive and move on rather than to let it continue to define us or be a part of us. So I know that's very quick, but I will hand it over to Fred.
Okay. What I'm getting from this, just a little nudge here, to carry on and tap into what Heisi has said and carried on. Something I've been talking with my own clients about whenever they're struggling with something emotionally, I actually take it to a place where they never anticipate me taking it, and I ask them, you know, in your everyday life, how much routine do you have set up? How many things, you know, what's your responsibility level? And also in the course of carrying out those responsibilities, how well are you attending to the basics of your life? Getting enough exercise, getting the proper nutrition, having a friend or a close family member where you can pick up the phone and call, the text message or an email or whatever communication method or form that you use, you know, are the places in which your everyday life you can find a balance. Because the more you can do things to help you feel, to help yourself feel connected and whole and a good equilibrium, that greatly contributes to emotional well-being and mental health.
Okay. I see.
Does that make sense to you? Okay. Do you think that's something that you can start to implement in your life?
Yeah. That's something I've been talking to some people about doing and was kind of going back and forth. So actually, that's really good confirmation. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. And don't underestimate the power of water. So get yourself out by water. And being in San Francisco, you have water very accessible to you. I would encourage you to make the time to be out by the water on a regular basis, as well as to be in water if you can take a bath or something like that, or even just to drink more water. And even if you have any sort of a spiritual practice, to maybe make a primary focus on water in some way. You can create a water altar, so you're literally connecting with that element at a deeper level and allowing it to come into you and speak to you and flow through you. And because the Nile came up, there's this sense, you know, the Nile was kind of a source of life. So you want things to bubble up. And in some ways, the river represents learning how to control the emotions more, to hold the water in place. But the Nile also flooded every year, so it also encourages us to allow emotions to come out rather than holding them in so much, at least once in a while.
All good things in moderation.
That's right. So hopefully,
I'll work on that then.
Yeah. So thank you for calling in, and hopefully that helped.
Yeah.
And
thank you.
I thank you to Fred for joining us today. And if you can, just remind people the phone number they can reach you at, Fred.
Certainly. And first of all, thank you, Heisi, for having me on today. You can reach me on my cell phone number, 314-255-5877. And also, again, once I'm back home and plugged back into all my things and mentally plugged back into the workspace, I will be sure to forward HiSi some other contact information so that there's email and another phone number to reach me at and things like that.
All right. So thank you, everyone, for listening today. And join us next week on Firefly Willows Live for Convergence with John Carosella. That's Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Pacific. And we will look forward to having you join us again then. Until then, ciao.
To learn more about today's guests or one of the topics discussed, go to fireflywillows.com/live. And for more information about Firefly Willows LIVE upcoming shows, visit our page at blogtalkradio.com/fireflywillowsLIVE. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. Join us next week as John Carosella hosts Convergence. He'll talk with Tom Cowan, scholar and teacher of Celtic shamanism and author of Fire in the Head, a lyrical and penetrating exploration of the shamanic roots of the Celtic spirit. John also relates what the family dog taught him about God, shares his insights on control versus mastery, and much more. This is Deb Carosella. Please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE, Blog Talk Radio.